You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
We were in this wheat field and the grain stood almost breast high. The Rebs had their slight protection, but we were in the open, without a thing better than a wheat straw to catch a mini bullet that weighed an ounce. Of course, our men began to tumble. They lay where they fell, or, if able, started for the rear. Near to me, I saw a man named Daly go down, shot through the neck. I made a movement to get his gun, but at that moment, I was struck in the shoulder.
It did not hurt, and the blow simply caused me to step back. I found that I could not work my arm, but supposed that hurt was a flesh wound that had temporarily paralyzed it, and that it was not serious enough to justify my leaving the fighting line. So I remained and did what I could in directing the firing. Sometime after this, I felt a blow on the left leg, and it gave way so that I knew the bone was broken. This stroke did not hurt, and I did not fall, but turned around and made a number of hops to the rear, when my foot caught in the tangled grain, and I went down full length. While lying here, entirely helpless, and hearing those vicious bullets singing over my head, I suffered from fear.
In a short time, I heard a line of battle advancing from the rear. As the men came in sight, I sang out, "Don't step on me, boys!" Those in range of me stepped over and rushed forward and fought the enemy in advance of the line we occupied. It was not many minutes after these troops passed me that the rattle of musketry was again heard from that wheat field. It was kept up for a good while, and then it died down.
After a while, I was aware that a skirmish line was coming from the front, and soon discovered that the skirmishers were not clothed in blue. The officer in command was mounted and rode by within a few feet of me. This fighting was not severe, and a short time after, these gentlemen in gray moved back in the same manner they had advanced, greatly to my relief. I did not fancy remaining their guest for any length of time.
As the Rebs went back, a nice-looking young fellow, small of stature, with bright black eyes, whose face was smutted up with powder and smoke, came along where I lay. My sword was on the ground beside me. He picked it up and said, "Give me that scabbard." I said, "Johnny, you will have to excuse me, as my arm is broken, and I can't unbuckle my belt." He made no comment, but went off with my sword. Lieutenant Charles A. Fuller, 61st New York Infantry, Crosses Brigade, Caldwell's Division, 2nd Corps, Army of the Potomac.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 353 of our Civil War podcast. My name is Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. As y'all recall, in the last show, Caldwell's hard-hitting 2nd Corps Division cleared the wheat field, but we said the challenge, obviously, would be for Caldwell to hold what he had won. And that wouldn't be easy because, as we said at the very end of the last episode, Events a bit farther up the line once again impacted the situation in the wheat field with startling suddenness.
For whatever reason, Confederate Corps Commander James Longstreet was allowing far too much delay between the attacks of his brigades. As we said in the last show, Longstreet had held back Kershaw's brigade of South Carolinians, the right front brigade of Lafayette McLaws' division, so that Tighe Anderson's Georgians had been unsupported on their left and had been fought to a bloody standstill along the edge of the wheat field.
Then Longstreet delayed the advance of McLaws' left front brigade so that Kershaw, in turn, was unsupported on his left, where he was mercilessly hammered by many of the 40 Federal guns concentrated in the salient, or outward jutting angle, of the Union line that was capped by the Peach Orchard.
Directly in front of the Peach Orchard and its deadly array of Federal artillery batteries was McLaws' left front brigade, a solid mass of Mississippians, commanded by 41-year-old Brigadier General William Barksdale. A lawyer, newspaperman, and politician before the war, Barksdale had also been a fervent fire eater, one of those fanatical pro-slavery agitators whose efforts finally plunged the nation into civil war. To his credit, Barksdale didn't shrink from the full implications of the position he had taken, and he had raised a regiment and had fought at First Manassas and at most of the other major battles in the Eastern Theater.
After 2 years of fighting, his hard-driving aggressiveness and consistent success in combat had gained him a general's commission, along with an enviable reputation as one of the Army of Northern Virginia's premier brigade commanders. Here, on July 2nd, at Gettysburg, Barksdale waited restlessly while the Confederate artillery began its long duel with the Union guns in the Peach Orchard salient.
Barksdale watched with growing impatience as first Hood's division off to the south, and then, just to his own right, Kershaw's and Semmes' brigades of his own division advanced across the open fields toward Hawk's Ridge and Rose's Woods. As the artillery bombardment entered its second hour, a thoroughly exasperated Barksdale sought out both Lafayette McLaws and James Longstreet and pleaded to be sent into the fight. "Wait a little," was Longstreet's reply, and Barksdale had to summon what little patience he had left, while just to the south, the brigades of Tighe Anderson, Kershaw, and Semmes struggled mightily to push the stubborn Yankees back and gained possession of Rose's Woods, the wheat field, and Stony Hill.
At last, when Longstreet believed the time was right, he gave the word to McLaws, who sent an aide galloping to Barksdale, who was overjoyed to finally receive the order to advance. The brigade of Mississippians surged forward, raising the rebel yell, and slammed into the Federal position at the Peach Orchard.
Because Dan Sickles had moved his troops forward to a new line that was longer than he had the manpower to cover adequately, the Federals at the Peach Orchard, like the rest of the Third Corps, were spread thinner than they should have been. Barksdale's hard-charging Mississippians tore into them ferociously. We'll talk in more detail about the collapse of the Federal salient at the Peach Orchard in the next episode, but for now the important thing to understand is that the collapse of the Union position at the Peach Orchard reverberated along the Federal line back to Stony Hill, Rose's Woods, and the wheat field.
In the last episode, we talked about how, on the Federal side, Caldwell's division had cleared the wheat field. It had been three of Caldwell's brigades, led by Cross, Zook, and Kelly, that had advanced and regained much of the lost ground in the wheat field and on Stony Hill, although they were fast running out of bullets. Caldwell's 4th Brigade, commanded by 25-year-old Colonel John Brooke, had lined up along the Wheatfield Road and watched as the action swirled and raged and unfolded before them.
Knowing his men would soon be called upon, Brooke, a Philadelphia native, made his way over to his old command, the 53rd Pennsylvania, and told them, "Boys, remember the enemy has invaded our soil. The eyes of the world are upon us, and we are expected to stand up bravely to our duty." Like Patrick Kelly's Irish Brigade, Brooke's brigade had also been sadly depleted, with just 900 or so men in its five regiments here at Gettysburg. Nevertheless, when he received orders to move up and relieve Cross's men, Brooke's brigade swept forward with a fury through the wheat field, under a murderous fire. The noise of battle, said one of Brooke's officers, quote, was almost deafening.
Knowing his brigade wasn't big enough to get involved in a long, drawn-out, stand-up fight with the Confederates, Brooke ordered his men to fix bayonets, and they charged forward with a yell through the wheat, up and over that much-fought-over stone wall, and through the trees of Rose's Woods, driving Tige Anderson's thoroughly worn-out Georgians before them.
But Brooke's attack came to a sudden halt when the men reached the western edge of Rose's Woods and ran headlong into Paul Semmes' relatively unbloodied brigade from McLaw's division. Some of Anderson's men, reforming to the right of their fellow Georgians in Semmes' brigade, began firing into Brooke's left, forcing Brooke to refuse or bend back that end of his line to confront those Confederates. Having advanced well beyond any immediate support, Brooke knew his embattled regiments wouldn't be able to hold on for long, and so he sent word back to Caldwell, asking the division commander for help.
Caldwell was already desperately looking about for help to hold the ground that his division had just gained. He first called on a wounded James Barnes, who had sent two of his 5th Corps brigades, under Tilton and Schweitzer, to help earlier in the fight for Stony Hill. However, as y'all recall, those two brigades had pulled back to Trossel's Woods when things got too hot in the kitchen in the wheat field in Stony Hill.
Now the men of Tilton's and Schweitzer's brigades were clinging to their positions in Trossel's Woods. However, Caldwell told Barnes that Brooke's troops were, quote, driving the enemy like hell over yonder, end quote. That is, over yonder in Rose's Woods, and that they needed support. Barnes agreed to send in Schweitzer, and after delivering some stirring words of encouragement, Barnes ordered Schweitzer's men forward into the trampled wheat.
Minutes later, Caldwell encountered General Roman Ayres, the thickly bearded career soldier commanding the 2nd Division of the 5th Corps. When George Meade sent the 5th Corps to back up Sickles' suddenly precarious position on the Union left, Ayres' three brigades had followed Barnes' division south toward the threatened sector.
Arriving by way of the Wheatfield Road, Weed's brigade, at the head of Ayres' column, had broken away from the division and advanced up Little Round Top, arriving there in time to both turn back the final Confederate attack up its slopes and to help render the hilltops secure.
Weed's departure left Ayres with his remaining two brigades, commanded by Colonels Sidney Burbank and Hannibal Day, each consisting entirely of regiments of regular U.S. Army troops. As Weed's men advanced up Little Round Top, Ayres deployed Burbank's and Day's brigades into line of battle, with Burbank's troops in front and Day's men behind them in support.
The regulars then swept steadily forward, across the Plum Run Valley and on toward the wheat field, all the while exposed to what one officer described as a, quote, unquote, most destructive fire, poured into the blue columns from Confederates positioned around Devil's Den.
Caldwell and Ayres were discussing the situation when their conversation was interrupted by an uneasy officer on Ayres' staff by the name of William Powell. "General, you had better look out. The line in front of you is giving way," said Powell.
Caldwell took offense at the thought that his men were being driven back by the enemy. He snapped, "That is not so, sir. Those are my troops being relieved." A few moments ticked by before Powell, not convinced by Caldwell's version of events, again interrupted, addressing his superior directly. "General Ayers, you will have to look out for your command. I don't care what anyone says. Those troops in front are running away." Peering through the smoke and into the wheat field, Caldwell and Ayers realized that the Federal troops were indeed running. Once more, the Union line was broken, and the tide of battle in the wheat field had turned yet again.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Following Barnes' orders, Schweitzer had led his three regiments into the wheat and all the way across the field to that stone wall lining its southern border. Soon after arriving at that spot, Schweitzer saw Brooks' men now streaming back through the trees to his right.
For 20 minutes, Brooke had done all that he could to hold his ground on the western edge of Rose's Woods. He had sent for help, but before reinforcements could arrive, the young brigade commander realized his deteriorating tactical situation left him no choice but to order a withdrawal. His men were reluctant to give up their advanced position and fell back only grudgingly. Brooke himself had to be helped to the rear after a bullet slammed into his ankle.
With Brooke's Federals giving way before them, Tige Anderson's exhausted but determined Georgians summoned up the energy to join Sims' Georgians in advancing through the trees of the Rose Wood lot toward the wheat field, where they drew fire from Schweitzer's Yankees, just then going into position at the stone wall.
The situation quickly became critical for Schweitzer, because not only were Brooks' men falling back, but so too were Zook's and Kelly's brigades. You see, Zook's men and the Irish Brigade were falling back from Stony Hill in the face of yet another fresh, unbroken line of rebel troops that was bearing down on them from the west.
Those fresh rebel troops were William Wofford's All-Georgia Brigade from McLaws' division. As y'all recall, McLaws had deployed his division with Kershaw and Sims, one behind the other on the right, while Barksdale and Wofford followed the same arrangement on the left. After smashing the Federal salient at the Peach Orchard, most of Barksdale's men would then turn north and advance up the Emmitsburg Road, but not Wofford's 1,400 Georgians, who continued driving eastward, advancing along the axis of the Wheatfield Road.
Seeing the unbroken ranks of Wofford's brigade advancing into the fight breathed new life into Kershaw's South Carolinians, who were bunched up near the Rose Farm, and they again moved forward to the attack, pressing toward Zook's and Kelly's Federals on Stony Hill.
Taking fire again from the front and flank, and now with Wofford's Georgians moving behind them, the Federals of Zook's and Kelly's brigades abandoned Stony Hill, leaving Schweitzer's men, for the moment, as the only Yankees left defending the wheat field.
Schweitzer's three Massachusetts, Michigan, and Pennsylvania regiments were facing south and firing at the Confederates, who were approaching through Rose's Woods. But when bullets began striking Schweitzer's men from the right and rear, fired by the rebels who now occupied Stony Hill in force, the man carrying the brigade flag leaned over to Schweitzer and said, "Colonel, I'll be damned if I don't think we are faced the wrong way."
Schweitzer sent back for help, but Tilton's brigade had by now also fallen back, and General Barnes was nowhere to be found. Schweitzer realized that his men were about to be surrounded.
To meet the threat on his right, Schweitzer turned the 62nd Pennsylvania and 4th Michigan to face west. The combat, said one of the Federals, quote, "waxed hot and furious." Some of the fighting was hand-to-hand. During the deadly melee, the flag of the 4th Michigan fell to the ground and was picked up by a Confederate soldier. Not wanting his regiment's colors to be captured, Colonel Harrison Jeffords, in what remains one of the most famous incidents of the Wheatfield fight, lunged forward and wrestled the flag back. He was shot and then moments later run through with a bayonet. Harrison Jeffords saved his regiment's colors, but it cost him his life.
Caught in a hopeless situation, Schweitzer gave the orders for his men to retreat, and what remained of his shattered brigade raced their way back, their retreat covered in part by Ayres regulars, who were by that time just then advancing into the bloody wheat field.
Ayres had ordered his men into the whirlwind of combat that was the battle for the wheat field to support both Caldwell and Schweitzer. The regulars of Burbank's brigade, advancing with parade ground precision, led the way, sweeping forward into the trampled wheat and directly into disaster. Burbank's men were immediately savaged in front, flank, and rear by musket fire from the soldiers of at least four Confederate brigades converging from the south and west.
Major Arthur Lee, whose 2nd U.S. Infantry held the right of Burbank's line, later said, quote, "A fresh column of the enemy at this time appeared on our right, and we were ordered to retire. The word was scarcely given when three lines of the enemy, elevated one above the other on the slope to our right on Stony Hill, poured in a most destructive fire, almost decimating my regiment."
Burbank's Federals retreated, falling back, quote-unquote, as if on drill, as the bullets continued to tear into their ranks. The regulars of Day's brigade, who had advanced behind Burbank, were also caught up in the maelstrom. Up on Little Round Top, one of the volunteer citizen soldiers of Weed's brigade watched the destruction of Burbank's and Day's brigades. He would never forget the scene and the heavy price paid by the regulars. That man later said, quote, "For 2 years, the U.S. regulars taught us how to be soldiers. In the wheat field at Gettysburg, they taught us how to die like soldiers."
In just a few minutes of savage combat, Burbank lost nearly half his men, with his casualties totaling almost 450 of the 950 soldiers he took into the fight, while Day's losses were slightly fewer, with 382 of his men killed or wounded.
Flush with victory and now having smashed Ayres' regulars, Confederate soldiers swept triumphantly into the wheat field. Of course, by this time, much of their strength had been sapped by the fierce fighting and their heavy losses, particularly in Tige Anderson's brigade, the only unit on either side to have been involved in the battle for the wheat field from start to finish. Anderson himself had been wounded early in the struggle, while his brigade would lose nearly half of its 1,400 men.
The 11th Georgia suffered the most, losing 201 of its 310 men, a staggering 65% loss, followed closely by the 8th and 9th Georgia, which each lost 55% of its men.
Still, despite their losses, these Confederate soldiers from Anderson's, Kershaw's, and Semmes' brigades would press on, sweeping through the trampled, bloody wheat and on toward the northern slopes of Little Round Top, while to their left rear, Wofford's brigade continued moving steadily on.
As the fighting moved on, the Rose wheat field had been transformed into a wretched place, occupied by the dead and suffering, its 20 acres trampled and made bloody by the fearful and murderous struggle that had raged there. 5 decades later, an aging Robert Carter, who had served as a private in the 22nd Massachusetts, still vividly remembered the horrific scenes that played out there, describing the fierce combat as, quote, a perfect hell on earth, never, perhaps, to be equaled, certainly not to be surpassed, nor ever forgotten in a man's lifetime. It has never been erased from my memory, day or night, for 50 years.
No doubt the majority of those involved in the bloody fight for the wheat field at Gettysburg would have agreed with Carter's description of it as a perfect hell on earth. But that phrase probably would have also been used by those who fought a bit farther north and west, in and around the Peach Orchard, and we'll cover that struggle in the next episode.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation. But rather than a book recommendation, we thought we'd take a moment to share our memory of visiting the wheat field during our trip to Gettysburg 2 years ago.
The wheat field was one of the spots we visited the day before our meetup with some of you listeners that June. We had rented a couple of bicycles and were riding around the battlefield, which we highly recommend as a mode of transport. And when we got to the wheat field, I don't think there was anyone else there. It was an absolutely beautiful summer morning as we left our bikes by the road and walked up the slope toward the cannon that marked the position of Winslow's battery. I remember how pleased I was to see there were some lovely wildflowers blooming in the field. As some of you know, I'm an enthusiastic, if not very good, amateur landscape photographer, and I was lugging my camera around with us, and so got a few shots with the flowers in the foreground and the cannon behind them. But, you know, as we took in that scene there, all by ourselves, it was almost impossible to imagine that that same piece of ground had been fought over so violently by so many men on July 2nd, and that by the end of the day, thousands of them were lying there dead or wounded. Really, of course, no one, unless they were there that terrible day in July 1863, can imagine what it was like.
The next time you're at Gettysburg, we'd love if you shared with us some of your thoughts and feelings as you visited different spots on the battlefield. As Rich said, we visited the wheat field the day before we met up with some of you and walked Pickett's Charge, which was a special experience.
We'll probably be getting to Pickett's Charge in another 30 or 40 episodes. Anyway, meeting some of you at Gettysburg seems like a good segue to thank those of you who have signed up recently to join the Strawfoot Brigade and support the podcast over on Patreon, like Irvin, Steve, Afif, Charles, Jim S., Bradley, Jim D., Matt, and Janine.
And thanks to Kara, Sven, Andrew, Mark, Aaron, and Kenneth for their recent donations.
And just a reminder as we wrap things up that the music you hear at the beginning and end of every episode is from the song Midnight on the Water by Spiritwood Music, and we use it with their kind permission.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Civil War, 1861 to 1865. a history podcast. Rich and I do hope that you join us again next time. But until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.